This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I want to thank each and every one of you listeners for tuning in week after week and listening to these podcasts. And now we're up to number 566. And this particular guest that I have this week, I would like to have saved for a very special episode for, let's say, the number 600 episode. But the way things are going, that may not come about until 2021. So I don't want to hold off that much longer because I want to share this fantastic and very interesting and provocative episode that we have here with my guest this week. Harry Lorraine is my guest, and he is someone that Magic Magazine had said that he is in the top 100 of the most influential magicians of the 20th century. And I have to agree that I was lucky to get to chat with him. I had a while back talked with Mayor Yedid, who had said probably a good idea to give him a call. And I've known Harry for quite some time, and we haven't really talked for a while. And he doesn't travel much, but he has been at home. And so it was a perfect opportunity for me to give him a call. And we had just a delightful conversation. And there is no subject that is off base. And as you listen to this podcast, you will hear a lot of frank conversation. And I don't mean just frank, but I also mean like Frank Garcia, other kinds of very candid comments that he shares with us. And right now, he had just recently passed his 94th birthday. And I thought it was important also because among the many friends he talks about, like Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, and having performed for Frank Sinatra and all of these other great people that we just this past week, as we are posting this podcast, have seen the loss of another one of his friends, Carl Reiner. And I know that Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks were together for a long time as comedy partners on stage and off, and so it was saddened by the fact that Carl Reiner has passed. And I know that Harry is as well, because he is one who counted Carl among his friends then as well. And the stories that he shares this week are just epic, and I'm so glad we had a chance to talk. And so this is a little bit more lengthy than our typical conversations that last for about an hour, but I think that the content that he offers, it's well worth your listens. So please, just set some time aside to really listen and enjoy the conversation with this memory expert, with this great magician, a friend to many, and he is a prolific author. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Harry Lorraine, here on The Magic Word. I have with me today someone that I've been wanting to talk to for a long time, and I've been doing this podcast for nearly 10 years, and it gives me really great pleasure to talk with every guest I do have every week, and none have really this level of status and legendary status, I should say, within our community. And it's someone actually who was said by Stan Allen in Magic Magazine some years ago as being one of the top 100 influential magicians in the world. And so please welcome my good friend, memory expert and cardician, Mr. Harry Lorraine. Hey, Harry.
Hey, Scott. Nice to hear your voice. Nice to talk with you.
It's my pleasure. Glad to talk with you there in New York City. You live in the city, is that right?
Or
you?
No. I'm in Newburyport, Massachusetts.
Oh, Massachusetts. Okay. That's a beautiful area up there. I like that. You know, one of the things first comes to mind whenever I think of you is I think of that Hirschfeld picture that he had drawn of you.
Oh, yes.
That was an illustration. You know, did you know Hirschfeld, or how did that come about?
Well, we belonged to a club called The Players in New York City.
Yeah.
And I was emceeing a show. As a matter of fact, I think Panatella was on it. I can't think who else, but I was the MC. Mm-hmm. I remembered everybody's name to open, blah, blah, blah. And I was wearing a tuxedo, which I don't usually do, in a bow tie, which is why that picture has me with a bow tie. Uh-huh. And anyway, he was in the audience. And he got all excited after the show. We went down to the basement after the actual show, and I did some card magic. And he finally said to me, "Harry, can you come to my house?" He lived on 92nd Street somewhere in New York City. Anyway, long story short, I went there with my wife, and we got friendly. And while we were talking, he was sketching. And a week or so passed, and he sent me a video of the drawing he had made. That's it. He did it free of charge.
Well, now, was this something in which, did you know when you were going over that he was actually going to draw you, or did you just go over thinking you're having a cup of coffee and chatting with someone?
You know, that's an interesting question, Scott. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if he said, I want to do a caricature of you. I have a feeling he did. I don't know if I would want, you know, I lived all the way downtown in New York. So okay. Going up to 92nd Street was a bit of a schlep, you know, it was a trip. So he must have said, yeah, I want to talk to you and do a caricature. So I'm assuming that's what happened.
And the reason I was mentioning that is because that is one of those chats that I regret that didn't come about. Actually, I had lined up with him through his agent to talk with him for Magic Magazine. So this was long before I was doing podcasts. So this would have been probably long about maybe 2002 or something. The point is that we got together, talked about it, and said this is going to be great. Let's do it. And so we had a time, and I never heard from him. I called in a couple hours later, and the lady picked up, who was his manager, and said, well, we were waiting for your call and never got it. I said, well, I thought you were going to call me. And she said, we're going to have to do this later, and like maybe next week. And he died within like 3 days. So, man.
But bad timing.
It was horrible. Yeah, but that was my close. I almost got to chat with him. The reason I want to talk with him is because of his relationship to magicians, because he had drawn of Houdini and David Copperfield and you. And I don't know who else, but those are the three that I know that he had drawn then as well. And his agent, I thought was interesting because she had once been an agent for Max Maleeny.
Oh.
Now, which brings me to the next thing, is I wondered if you ever saw Max Maleeny, because he was in New York City, and I thought he belonged to the Players or something.
No, I think probably he died. He must have been much older than me, because I never met him.
Okay, I just wondered if perhaps in your youth you may have seen him or had a brush with him somewhere.
No.
So anyhow, did you learn to memorize cards, and did you have your own stack before Aaron Simon and everybody else way back when?
When I got interested in memory, I was 10 and a half, 11 years old.
Okay.
But I didn't get interested in it for my magic. I got interested in it, Scott, because I was dyslexic, which I didn't know. You know, all I know, I don't know if you want me to go into detail here, but one day on the Johnny Carson show, Johnny said to me, Harry, how does somebody, a D's, Dems, and Do's kid from the Lower East Side of Manhattan with no education, blah, 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 become the world's leading memory training specialist? And I said, stomach cramps. And he got a little white under his makeup because he thought I went nuts. Then I explained it. Scott, when I was very young, there was a teacher by the name of Mrs. Goldfisher, and she gave us a test every day, 10 questions. You know, I think she had said in the classroom, things that she told us to read, etc. Uh-huh. The point is, she wanted us every day to bring it home for at least one parent to sign. And I was getting marks like 40 and 50, whereas most of my other classmates were getting passing grades. Right. And the reason I was getting stomach cramps is my father, who died when I was 12, so you can see how far back I'm going, he was the signee, and when he saw my grades, he would punish me. He would punch me. Hmm. That's what gave me stomach cramps. Every day, I was so scared. And do you know how I realized that the stomach cramps were from that? I didn't get them on non-school days. I didn't get it on Saturday and Sunday. I only got it on school days when I was bringing home that darn test that Mrs. Goldfisher had given us. But that's what started me in memory. And how that started was very simple. I was walking with this test in my hand, and I was so scared. And all of a sudden, the light bulb went off when I said to myself, how in the world can I stop my father from hitting me? And the answer, the light bulb went off. Simple. Get better darn marks on these damn tests.
Sure.
Then the next question came up. How do I do that? You know, in those days, I never heard the word dyslexia. I don't know if my teachers knew about it. I never heard it. In those days, and I've written about this, Scott, you know, they give you the name, you play the game. They stamped me moron. I thought I was a moron, you know. Mm-hmm. But as I say, the light bulb went off two times. One, how do I avoid my father hitting me? Two, get better grades. Now the third one, how do I do that? Simple. Remember the darn answers to the questions that Mrs. Goldfish was asking. That changed my life. Of course, the next thing I did, I went to the library and asked if they had books that would help me remember things. And the teacher took me to a room in the corner to help me. It had cobwebs over the door. Nobody had been in there for God knows how long. She opened the door for me, and in the corner was a little section of books on memory training. I have some of them in my basement now. I own them. I stayed in that room for about 2 or 3 hours trying to understand. I understood maybe less than 1% of the things I was reading. You got to remember, Scott, I was 10 and a half, 11 years old.
Sure.
But the little bit that I understood, again, changed my life because I started to twist them and change them to apply to what I had to remember. There are questions like, what's the capital of Maryland? How the heck am I going to remember that? Well, what I was reading helped me to remember that. That's the point. I was changing them to help me remember that. I didn't realize that I was doing something, I don't know, good. I was changing it to fit my memory problem.
Kind of making your own system. It was through mnemonics, but you had your own system of mnemonics to kind of relate to those things.
Only to apply to the things I had to remember, right. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Because I've used this before, and I just mentioned it. What's the capital of Maryland? Well, you know, when you're 10 and a half, 11 years old, and you're taking a test, you don't intellectualize. You either know the answer or you don't.
Right.
And when the question about what's the capital of Maryland, you know, you ask people now, most people will say Baltimore. Well, it's not Baltimore, it's Annapolis. And what? Now, okay, I started to get better marks on my grades. One day I'm walking into the classroom and Mrs. Goldfish is asking me, Harry, what happened? All of a sudden you're getting hundreds, which I always thought you would get. What happened? I said, well, I learned how to remember. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, and I used this example. That's what reminded me. I said, one of the questions you asked is what's the capital of Maryland? And I knew it was Annapolis because I made an association in my mind. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, I visualized Mary, and I pointed to a little girl in my classroom who was named Mary, and I saw an apple. An apple is landing Mary on Mary's head, Maryland. An apple is, Annapolis, landing on her head. You know, as I was talking, it's funny, the things you remember when you're 10 and a half, 11 years old.
And the fact that still remembering that at this age.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you why. I'm talking to Mrs. Goldfish and telling her what I just told you, and I see her eyes glaze over, and she says, okay, Harry, take your seat. She thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
And I took my seat. I figured I'm not going to tell anybody. But you know what happened? My little girlfriends and boyfriends, my classmates, started to ask me, Harry, what did you do? Blah, blah, blah. And I explained it to them, and they started to use it. They didn't think I was nuts. Mrs. Goldfisher thought I was.
So everybody's grades went up. Thanks to
you. Oh, yeah. But they were doing fine without me, you know. But anyway, the reason I told you this whole thing, Scott, is a lot of people think that I got into memory because of my love for magic to remember cards. No, that came afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Can you believe I'm going to be 94 in about a week or so?
It's really going to be 94. Goodness.
Yep.
So you and also that your friend Mel Brooks also is about the same age. Isn't he about 93?
I'm about 6 weeks older than Mel Brooks. His birthday is toward the end of June. Mine is the beginning of May. Mm-hmm. And we always used to kid around about that. I'm older than you, Mel, so you got to call me sir. other than that, we're approximately the same age.
Yeah, did you meet him, I assume, as you were growing up as kids or just later in life?
No, we met, I was living on Jane Street in New York City, and a block away was an old girlfriend of mine by the name of Jeannie, who had married a guy by the name of Martin Charnin. Martin Charnin was the guy that did the show Annie, so he was pretty well known. Anyway, he was doing, helping out with a TV show for Anne Bancroft, Bell's wife. Mm-hmm. And they called me one day because I was only a block away. And they said, Harry, Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft are here for dinner because I'm working with Annie. Can you come over and join us? And I said, sure. You know, so my wife Renee and I went over, and that's where I met Mel Brooks, at Martin Charnin's house.
And you just kind of fell in friendship with him almost immediately, apparently.
Well, I'll tell you, talk about immediately. In those days, I don't know if you know the name Larry Parks. There was an actor by the name of Larry Parks who did a movie called The Jolson Story.
I remember The Jolson Story.
Yeah, well, that was Larry Parks was the star of that show. He played Al Jolson.
Was that the first actual talkie movie?
Oh, no. You're talking about you're just thinking about a movie that the real Al Jolson did. He did the first talkie movie.
That was The Jazz Singer, yeah.
There you go. See, so that's a whole different I don't know how many decades before
you're
this.
You're not that old.
No. So this was Larry Parks. Now, the reason I mention it, in those days, I didn't have this color hair, Scott. I had black hair, and I looked like a little bit, I was told, like Larry Parks. Okay. So what happened, and this was just when the Jolson Story was kind of at its height. So when I walked into the room where Mel Brooks and his wife, Anne Bancroft, were sitting, as soon as I walked in, Mel Brooks got up, got behind me, put his arms between my arms, and started to sing a Jolson song. So I went along with it, and I mouthed the words.
Yeah.
That's how we met.
That is funny.
Right.
His friend over there who just lives down the street there from L.A., my mind. Carl Reiner, yes. I guess got to know Carl through Mel.
We got very friendly. We are now coast-to-coast friends, you know, because I live in Massachusetts on the East Coast. They live in California. And Carl is older than both of us. I think he's close to 98. Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
Going back then again, we're talking about the memory. How did you become associated then with the basketball player?
I have a list of the biggest crooks that I met in my life, and he's number one.
Oh, my.
Come on. He's a big thief.
Okay.
When he came to me, it's interesting. My wife picked up the phone one day when it rang, and she said, Harry, Jerry Lewis is on the phone. She said, Jerry Lewis. I knew Jerry Lewis because I had done the Carson show when he was taking over for Johnny Carson, you know, the Tonight Show.
Right.
And we got kind of friendly. He asked for one of my books, etc. Anyway, I got on the phone, and it wasn't Jerry Lewis, of course. It was Jerry Lucas. And he said he'd like to meet me. Long story short, he came to my house. I lived in a townhouse, which I eventually sold for about $8 million. So it was a pretty nice house.
Yeah.
He walked in and stopped and looked around, and he said, you got this from magic? He thought that my livelihood was magic. Uh-huh. He had no concept of the memory. So I said, no, not from magic at all. From memory. He said, well, what do you mean? And I explained it all to him, and that's what started it. And I was just finished. I had just finished the book, the memory book. This was 1972, 73. And what happened is he was a very well-known name at the time. Not now, but he was then.
Right.
And gee, he said, I would love to be involved, blah, blah, blah. I put his name on it. I went through the book and I changed every I to the editorial we to make it look like we both wrote the book. He had as much to do with the book, Scott, as you did.
Okay.
So, you know, absolutely nothing.
Right.
But at that time, going out to help me with the publicity, etc., helped to make it a bestseller. You know, I got to be honest, I assume it did. He was a bit of a problem because every television show or radio show he did, he talked about basketball. And I had to keep calling him and say, look, Jerry, you could talk about basketball for a second, but the point is, you're there to sell the memory book, darn it, not to talk about basketball. So he really didn't know what the heck he was doing. That's how he got involved.
Wow. And then eventually you guys split and went your own ways.
Oh, he stole everything. He stole my childhood. He was doing a television show and people asked about his background, and he gave my childhood.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, he stole everything from me.
Did he tell that same story and that you had just told earlier and just assumed and said it was his story?
Right. He said I was born on a bed in a slum area. Everything about me and how he got involved in memory and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just stole everything from me.
Wow.
And then he moved to California and I never heard from him again.
Wow. Well, that's history then. Hopefully that's all under the bridge. And obviously you've moved on.
Done everything else.
Now, I was talking with Marietta a while back and he was discussing the Saturday morning time when you guys always get together there at the deli. I guess there have been some other places that you've met at different times. And it just seems like a weekly convention that went on that was an all day deal as far as whoever was in New York and visiting with you and everything.
Oh, you mean the magicians?
The magicians group. Yeah.
Oh no, that wasn't the morning. That was the afternoon. Scott, that was when after a lieutenant closed at 3 p.m.
Why would they close at 3 on Saturdays? I would think that'd be a busy day for him.
He always closed at 3 p.m. on Saturdays.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was always mobbed. I don't know how it is now. I know Tenants are still in existence and different people own it.
Yeah.
But I used to go up to Tenants. My gosh, the elevator doors would open and they opened right into his place and it was just mobbed. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it is now, but that was one of the most popular magic shops in the country, I've been told.
Well, they had those great catalogs that were just like the Sears Christmas catalog. It seemed like, you'd look forward to getting those big, thick books with all the wonderful illustrations and great tricks, that were in there.
Right. No, we used to call it the cafeteria. We all met at the cafeteria. After 3 p.m., after that, it's closed.
And then that kind of went on late into the evening, I guess?
Usually some of the people stay there for dinner. Other people had to get home, to their wives and family, whatever, sure. For dinner. But, yeah, some people stay there through dinner time. Cafeteria, where at first, that changed a couple of times, different cafeterias or different restaurants. But they would set aside in a corner of the place for us. And they didn't mind doing it because we all bought a lot of stuff. We gave a lot of business.
How many people typically would turn up? I mean, like 10,
sometimes
20 people?
Sometimes there was 20, 30 people.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Who are some of the people that you had seen come and go that you worked with?
Well, in those years, I was very friendly with Dave Vernon, John Scarney, Bill Simon, Jack Miller, all those names. My meeting with, I've talked about this, so maybe too repetitive for you. My meeting with John Scarney and Dave Vernon happened at Tannen's. If you want to hear that story,
I'd love to hear that.
Okay. I would come up when I didn't know about magic shows, magic shops, till I got out of the Army. I had enlisted in the Army. That's another long story, so I won't go into it. But I got out of the Army. I was about 18 and a half years old, okay? And I learned about magic shops. Go up to Tannen's, and I had read about magic. I read about the important people in magic. And as I told you before, when the elevator doors opened, you were there already in Tannen's. And standing off to my right every Saturday when I'd go up there was John Scarney, Dave Vernon, and S. Leo Horowitz. Mm-hmm. S. Leo Horowitz, I don't think is that well known, but obviously John Scarney and Dave Vernon. But what happened, and I've written about this, Scott, and I called them the triumvirate because what I did, I would love to have met them when I first started to go up there. When I took a step toward them, the three of them, as if it was a ballet, took a step away from me. So they weren't too happy about me walking toward them. So I tried every Saturday when I was there until I gave up. Then here's what happened. There was a magician around that time called Louis Zingoni, or Lou Zingoni, and he had a move called the Zingoni spread, and it was a very kind of complicated thing. He would have three people put their selected cards in a spread, that your face down spread of the deck on the table, and he would gather them. And now what he did, he counted where the top card was, how many cards were between the top card and the next card, and how many cards were between, and he would sit there and shuffle single cards, mm-hmm, to control those three cards. That was called the Zingoni spread. He did it very well, but there was a long time of peeling cards, which was not my kind of thing.
Right.
I came up with the spread control where there was no peeling necessary at all. I gathered the spread, shuffled, that was it. I got them. Okay, one day I'm up at Tannen's, and I'm at the glass counter, and a bunch of young people my age at that time around, and I'm doing the spread control, and I hear a voice behind me saying, "Hey, kid, do that again." And it was John Scotti. Wow. I was walking to the bathroom or whatever, and he sees me do this. So I do it again, shivering, shaking. You know, I was so nervous. But I do it again, and he turns to Dave Vernon and Sam Leo Horowitz, whose name was Sam, and he says, "Guys, come over here. Watch this kid do the Zingoni spread." He thought I was doing the Zingoni spread.
Oh, uh-huh.
So Dave Vernon and Leo Horowitz come over, and I do it again. And they say, "That is the best Zingoni spread we ever saw." And I wasn't about to tell them what I was doing. And that was it. I said, "Thank you, guys. Okay. Go to the next Saturday." The elevator doors open. There's the triumvirate, you know, John and Day and Sam. And now I take a step toward them, and they don't walk away. They let me approach. And Day says, "Hey, kid, you got another trick to show us?" And I said, "Sure." And I did some magic for them. And that's how we got friendly.
And you got to be friendly. Wow, what a good story. That is great. You know, when I think of Sam Horowitz, I used to get him confused with June Horowitz's husband, who's also was named Sam.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Interesting that you remember. Most of the people that I tell the story to, they don't know who Sam Horowitz was.
Yeah.
He didn't. I can't remember the name he used professionally. He said he didn't use Sam Horowitz. I know that.
He did and have a different stage name. Yeah, I don't remember either.
Yeah, but, right. Mm-hmm. I cannot think of it.
Now, was that around the time also that you came up with the Halo cut? I mean, which is a short, by the way.
No,
Halo
that did that.
Harry Lorraine.
No, that came. Yeah, no, that's right. It's answer Harry Lorraine. That was a long time after that. I didn't write it in my first book. I think I wrote that in my second or third book that I did myself. I don't mean the ones I did for Lou Tannen. I did four books for Tannen till I got smart and said, "I'll publish my own book."
You make more money when you publish your own, I guess.
Of course. And that was Reputation Makers. That was the first book I did under my own name. Mm-hmm. And after that, there were Rim Shots and Afterthoughts and Trendsetters. So it was in one of those books. Was the Halo cut, which I had been fooling magicians with for years. I didn't want to give it away,
right.
But then I did. Then I did. And, and Lou, you know, Lou didn't mind me leaving. Like I say, I did four books for him. I did Close Up Card Magic. You know, I didn't know that I was writing a classic at that time.
Close Up Card Magic is wonderful. Didn't that also include the Square Magic Square? I think that's in that book.
No, the Magic Square. You know something? I think I put that in the magic book, which I wrote for the public. Hmm. That was the first book I wrote for the public because I was forced to do it. That's another story. If you're interested, you got to remind me about it.
Okay.
But I wrote four books for Lou Tannen: Close Up Card Magic, Personal Secrets. The reason it was called Personal Secrets, I originally was, it was a P.S. to Close Up Card Magic. That's where the name came from. Yes, Personal Secrets, and my favorite card tricks, and then Dexterity. Those were the four I did for Lou.
For Lou.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that, like I say, I would have made a better deal. I think I got 10% for Close-Up Card Magic, and only for 2 years. So for all these decades, it's been selling. Otherwise, I don't get a percentage.
Wow. And what was one of your favorite books that you enjoyed writing that was the most fun?
Well, you know, whenever I wrote a book, I always enjoyed writing that particular book. So I never had any particular favorite. You know, the one that really stood out for me was the first one, was Close Up Card Magic, which, like I say, who thought I was writing a classic? Mm-hmm. And it seems that's what it became. But I was writing, you know, I had written two memory books prior to that. So the assumption was I knew how to write, but I didn't think this would become a, you know, the classic that it became.
One of your first books, I guess, was back in 1957. It was one of your...
You're right. My first book for the public was How to Develop a Superpower Memory. Came out in 1956.
Okay.
And then in 1960, the publisher asked me to do another book, and that became Secrets of Mind Power. So I had written two books for the public before 1962, when I did Close-Up Card Magic for the Magic Fraternity.
What about working and doing Apocalypse? I mean, that was something in which that, as opposed to a book, you can, as you know, work on that for as long as you want and put it out when you think it's ready. Whereas that if you have a publishing deadline, like you did with Apocalypse, of putting that out month after month, I think it was a quarterly or monthly. I think it was monthly.
It was a monthly.
Yeah.
You know, Scott, I look back all those years and I can't imagine how I did it. It was like one of the busiest times of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, it started 1978. I was traveling all over the world, lecturing, holding seminars. I was doing seminars in Japan, in Australia, in Manila, and making a lot of money. As nowhere near the magic was, it didn't come anywhere near that at all. Right. But magic was still my first love, and et cetera. And I can't. And in those days, you know, I didn't have a computer. You know, what we're doing right now, you know, to me is magic, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Really. So what was it called in those days? Oh, it was called cut and paste.
Yes.
In other words, I would get magic from people who wanted to be in Apocalypse after a while when it became known. And I rewrote every trick that was sent to me.
Did you?
Because, and I know this sounds egotistical, Scott, but you know something, at my age, I don't care. I'm gonna say it the way it is.
Of course.
Very rarely did I get a trick that was sent to me that was written as well or explained itself as well as I could do it. So I rewrote just about 99.99% of every trick that was sent to me. And then I typed it up myself. We didn't have the first few wishes of Apocalypse. If you look at them, there are no straight right margins.
Right.
In other words, I'm working on an old typewriter, really hitting those keys, and et cetera, et cetera. And that started to change a little. I got better, better typewriters. I was afraid when computers started to come in, I was afraid I'd lose whatever I was typing. So I stayed with the old typewriters. And like I say, I did, after I was finished, I had these special pages with graphs on them, and I would cut and paste. That's what I did, and take it to a printer. I would stay up till 3-4 some mornings finishing an issue because I wanted to get them out on time. I eventually made an arrangement with a company that shipped the issues every month to American subscribers, but I never could get someone to do the European. So I still did that myself. I had to schlep all those to the post office myself, for God's sakes. Like I say, I look back and I can't imagine that I did all this.
Well, that's
for
why
20
I had,
years.
For 20 years.
20 years
every month. I subscribed to that and had a lot of those original magazines, and then finally they were all put into bound booklets or books, which were great. Who did the illustrations for you?
Oh boy, it started a guy, I cannot think of his name. But eventually, there was a guy by the name of Joey Wierzbicki. Joey Wierzbicki became the Amazing Joseph, working out of Las Vegas, if he still is. I haven't heard from him in a while. And then, after a while, my son started to do it. So my son was doing the illustrations.
Is he doing illustrations now? I mean, was he schooled in art? No.
Not really. He was. He's a good drawer, if that's the word. I would pose for him, or he would take a picture and just copy it, etc., because I didn't know who else to do it. So he did the last, I don't recall how many years, but he did the last few years, the illustrations.
Have you thought about putting together the best of Apocalypse? I assume that there were some that you still have as part of your repertoire. You're thinking, oh, this is gold.
Matter of fact, the third book, let's see, my last book, which is available now, is called And Finally. Then there's Jaw Droppers 2. Jaw Droppers 1 sold out. And the book just before that answers your question. It's called Only My Apocalypse. So it's all my stuff from Apocalypse that I put in the book because I was asked to do so. Mm-hmm. A lot of people said to me, Harry, I'm tired of searching through 20 years of Apocalypse looking for your tricks.
Yeah.
So that gave me the thought. So I put my tricks that I had in those 20 years and put them in one book. And that's called Only My Apocalypse for that reason.
Yeah. That's, and And it's, I imagine, kind of like children, that you, it's hard to say, I like this baby better than another, but are there some, or is there one, something that kind of comes to mind that you like? I mean, do you have a go-to kind of a trick if somebody says, you know, show me a card trick? I mean, I know that you can go on for hours, but.
No, my go-to really in the last few decades is Halo Aces. Mm-hmm. Somebody gives me a deck. You know my introduction to that?
No.
I've got the deck on my hand, and I look through. I don't use my own decks, Scott. That's a whole other story. I've written about this so many times. If you're good, you are losing 10 to 20% of the effectiveness of what you're doing, the trick you're doing, if you use your own deck. And I've had over the years, I'm going back decades now, magicians who say to me, no, Harry, when I'm finished, I give the deck to one of the laymen. I give them the deck to... Well, I tried that once 30 or 40 years ago. I gave it to a lady. I can still visualize her. And she said, and I've written, I've quoted her so many times. I give her a deck. She says, I'm not a magician. I can't see the future in the deck. Well, obviously. So in other words, the only thing, if your magic is really good, if it's really strong, they are going to think it's a trick deck, because what you did is bloody impossible. Mm-hmm. So the only way, and nobody has changed my reasoning, to get out of that is to use their deck. That's the only way you're going to get away with that. So I use my own deck. And now to answer your question, somebody gives me a deck. I pretend I'm looking, is this a full deck, etc. And I'm getting the aces where I want them usually, and I'm shuffling. And here has been my pattern for years. You know, I've had this dream. I got to tell you, most people dream about making money. They dream about good health. They dream about love affairs, finding a good lover, things like that. No, I've always dreamed about something else that has to do with cards. And I'm talking about, I dreamt that I want to be able to do this with cards from anywhere in the world. Because at that time, Scott, I was a world traveler. And that's what started that talk. And part of my pattern was, any deck in the world, and if you people travel, you know that in many different countries, decks are a different thickness, different width, different weights, etc. I dreamt that I would be able to take any deck anywhere in the world and shuffle it and then cut a portion here and then cut a portion here. As a matter of fact, Sam, tell me when to stop shuffling. The person say stop, and I say, here, fine. And my dream was that I would be able, Scott, let me go back into Harry Lorraine character.
Okay.
I'm a good actor when it comes to magic. Annie Bancroft used to say to me, Harry, you are the best natural actor I ever saw. But she said that when she saw me do it magic. And I used to say, I wish I could do it out of magic. I would be a movie star. But I'm a good actor when it comes to magic. And the reason I mention that, as I'm ending what I'm doing here is the Halo Aces. As I'm ending, and I've told this whole story about my dream, I turn over the top card of one pile, then I turn over the other, and I start to slow down. And I say, you know, I turn over the third, they're aces. And I turn over the fourth, and I say, my dream just came true. That's the way I've been presenting it for years. Mm.
I do like that. Yeah, that's very clever, very clever. And in developing these over the years, obviously a lot of people have had a lot of input and everything that you've had that has gone into not just the apocalypse, but then into some of the books. I remember that you had solicited something, and I had something published in one of your books one time, and I'd forgotten even that it was in there until it actually got reviewed. I don't remember what the book was, but it was something having to do with just a handprint or a photocopy of a hand and a card appearing in that. Anyhow.
Photocopy of a hand? I don't remember that.
Using a Himber wallet, basically.
Maybe it was in the Himber wallet book.
I think it was in the Himber wallet book. That was why it was appropriate, I guess.
Right. I wrote that so many years ago, Scott, I've forgotten, you know.
Of course.
Really.
Of course.
I wrote two books. I wrote two books for Richard Himber. The first one was Best of Billfold, and then the Himber wallet book.
Did you know Richard Himber?
Sorry.
Did you know Richard?
Yeah, he was a very important friend of mine, which I'll tell you about if you want to hear about what happened with the Himber wallet. As I say, I wrote two books, The Best of Billfold for him, and then the Himba wallet. And what happened when most of my original books that I wrote sold out when I was younger, I would reprint, you know, a few times for each book if it was selling accordingly. But as I got older, I didn't want to do that anymore. So I put a lot of them in my, I get so emotional. Five books called Lorraine, the Classic Collections. So that is volume one, volume two, three, four, and five. And the Himba Wallet book, I think, is in volume five. In other words, I put three or four books in one volume. I started doing that originally. I wasn't going to do five volumes. I was going to do one because I started to recall that with my first few books, I didn't give a lot of credits where I should have given the credits, not because I was stealing stuff, but because I didn't know. Yeah. I simply didn't know. As I got older, obviously, I learned these things. So the reason for my first Lorraine, the Classic Collection, was to redo, update four books, my first four books, and to give credits, all the credits that were due. Those people who are going to listen to this, if they have the five volumes, they'll see that it doesn't say volume one on the first one. I didn't think I was going to do another one.
Of course.
It was just this first one. Then, of course, people got excited, thank God, and started to scream, Harry, do another, you know. Then it became volume two, volume three, and that's on the cover of the books. Volume one does not have volume one on it.
Yeah, right.
That reason, you know. But anyway, you asked me if I was a friend of Himba.
Yeah, because he was also, kind of, he was a, Richard Himba also was a band leader, as I recall.
Oh, yeah, that's what he was. That was his livelihood. Uh-huh. It Isn't Fair, that's a song he was known for. Himba was the kind of person, either you hated him or you loved him. Mm. I loved him. He did very important things for me. He got me my first job doing table magic because he saw me looking gloom and he said, what's up? I was 19 years old or something like that. And he said, Harry, what's the matter now? I said, I can't get a job. I would like to do, I thought card magic was going to be my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And I said, he whistled for a cab. That's what he used to do. We got into a cab. He took me to a place called Billy Reed's Little Club. Long story short, he took me in, he introduced me to Billy Reed, who was the manager of the club, and he got me a job there. I did close-up magic there every night after that, you know, working for tips, and the tips were pretty good. Frank Sinatra carried only $100 bills with him. So when he tipped you, it was a $100 bill. Wow. So, it was, and I had made the right choice because Billy Reed, when he hired me, said, which would you like to do, Harry? Do you want a salary, which we could discuss? Or do you want to work for tips? And I made the right choice. I said, I want to work for tips. And it was the right choice because it was the kind of place that very important, Reed, wealthy people came into so that my tips were much better than he could have given me a salary.
Well, that leads to a question I was going to ask you earlier about how that your main profession was in touring the world and talking about your memory course and how to do that and everything, and magic was always a love. Did you do very many private parties, corporate parties? Did you ever do trade shows or walk around strolling and or that kind of a
thing?
You mean with
magic?
With magic, yes.
When I was doing what I just told you at Billy Reed's Little Club, as I said, I thought that magic was going to be my, you know, I was interested in memory since I was a kid, 10 and a half, 11 years old.
Right.
And I used to do some of it to friends. I never thought, and I'll tell you that story. I can tell you the plot point that changed my life pertaining to that. So I loved it. I loved the memory thing, but magic I thought was going to be my life. And one of the things I did, I told you before about never using my own decks. A lot of times at the Little Club, somebody would say to me, Mr. Lorraine or Harry, we're having a bar mitzvah or we're having a party. Can you come and do some of this magic for the party? And I'd say, sure. And we'd make arrangements. And I said, after we discussed the money part, I'd say, one other thing, Mr. Whatever, I want you to get two decks of cards for me, one with a blue back, one with a red back. And I want you to hold them for me. And when you introduce me at your home or wherever you're holding a party, I want you to tell the audience that these are your cards.
Right.
This was all very important to me. I would not use my own deck. Now, this is going to sound, again, very egotistical, very braggadocio, but I think I mentioned to you before, at my age, I don't care. I'm going to say it the way it is.
Good.
The kind of stuff I did to a lay audience was so impossible that it had to be a trick deck. So I simply would not use my own cards. I haven't for 30 or 40 years. I'll do it for other magicians because they know I'm using a regular deck, or I'm lecturing and I'm going to teach them the trick. But for laymen, I would never use my own deck. Okay. So to answer your question, yeah, I did some of those things when I was 19 years old or around that age, working at Billy Reed's Little Club. But now, if you want to know what changed my life...
I was going to ask you, what changed your life?
It happened at Billy Reed's Little Club. There was an actor by the name of Victor Jory. I don't think too many people know that name now.
I don't know that name.
He was a pretty important actor. He played Helen Keller, the blind girl. Mm-hmm. He played Helen Keller's father in a movie called... The Miracle Worker.
Miracle Worker, sure. Mm-hmm.
And the reason I know it is I get a little emotional. My closest friend, Annie Bancroft, played Helen Keller's teacher in that movie, for which she won the Academy Award, and that was in 1962. So you see how far back I'm going, okay? Yeah, right. I have a letter on my wall from Annie Bancroft. Of course, she always used my sisters, as did Mel Brooks. They did a movie together where they did Sweet Georgia Brown. The show opened with the two of them on stage singing Sweet Georgia Brown in Polish. And originally, they were looking at a big thing, the Polish words, but the camera was catching them glancing. It was not good. I taught them how to remember the lyrics to Sweet Georgia Brown in Polish. Oh. So anyway, I have a letter from Annie Bancroft telling me how she remembered all her lines in plays, in movies, etc., using my sister. They were good students of mine. And she ends the letter by saying, "You are a miracle worker."
Wow.
And I have that framed on my wall.
That's pretty special.
And if we were visualizing, I would show it to you, but I don't think you'd taking pictures.
Not
right?
For the podcast, no.
You're just hearing my beautiful New Yorkese voice is what you're doing.
Mellifluous.
So look, Victor Jory was a little interested in magic. He comes in with a friend, another man, and I do my typical thing that I was doing at every table, but it was Victor Jory, who was very famous at the time, but I didn't do it then. I did my regular thing. I get a tip from him, and they leave. About 3 or 4 days later, he comes in with a different guy. And he says, "Harry, I'd like you to do what I do. But now, it's the way my mind works. He had seen this, the set that I did last time. So I wanted to do at least one trick that I hadn't seen before. So I did. I finished my regular set. And they said, "Mr. Jory," he had said, "call me Victor," said, "Victor, one more trick." And I did a different card trick. A week later, he comes in with a different guy. Same thing. And I do a different trick at the end. I'll make a long story short. He comes in 10, 11, 12 times.
Wow.
Different people each time. So he knew forwards and backwards what I was going to do for my regular set. But each time I did a different trick for him, and what started to happen, you got to remember, I'm 19 years old. The stuff I knew, the different tricks I knew, was finite. I knew so many tricks. Mm-hmm. You know, and years went on, you give me a deck of cards, I'd make them up as I went along.
Yeah.
But I wasn't able to do that then. So again, the point of the story, I knew he was going to come in again. I said, "I don't know what I don't have another card trick to show him." I said, "Okay, I'll do a memory thing for him." To me, that was like scratching the bottom of the barrel, you know. But I didn't have a choice. Boy, I got emotional again when I talk about this. I did something for him that people told me afterwards, nobody in the world could do a memory stunt like you're doing. Would you like me to explain what I did?
I would love, yeah.
I'm going to tell you exactly what I did for him.
Yeah.
Because I had to look it for other people, not other friends, etc. I said, would you pick up the deck we're just using, Mr. Jory, you know, a regular deck? I would like you to shuffle them thoroughly. He did. I said, I would like you to call them out pretty rapidly at about this speed. And I did this. Okay. But I said, I did this, you're not seeing. I showed him with my hands, or I'd snap my fingers at the speed, which is a normal speed.
Yeah.
He called off the entire shuffle deck. I told him, turn the deck face down, square up. I said, now, give me any number from 1 to 52. He said 8. They said jack of clubs. And I said, count to the 8th card, but don't mess them up. Count them to keep them in position.
Order,
right. He did. Right. There's the jack of clubs. Give me another number, 42. The 2 of clubs. He counted the 47. There it was. I did that 3 times. Then I said, you name a card. He said, okay, the 7 of spades. And I say, 12th card. He counted a 12th card. There was the 7 of spades. I did that 3 times. And the ending was, Victor, do you play cards? Yes. Do you play poker? Yes. Do you know what is the best hand in poker? He said, yeah, the Royal Flush. I said, yes. What is your favorite suit? Clubs, hearts, spades, or diamonds?
Man.
He'd say spades. I'd say, okay, spades, Royal Flush. Look at the 5th, 12th, 34th, 42nd, and 43rd cards, which he did, and there was the Royal Flush in spades.
Wow.
Now, that's the trick I did. Listen to what happened. He sits there, like, silent for about 10 seconds. He stands up, and he starts to applaud. And he says in a loud voice, you know, Billy Reed's called the Little Club because it was a little club. Everybody could hear him. And he said, Harry, all the stuff, that sleight of hand that you did with cards for the past 12 weeks or whatever, was the best sleight of hand I've ever seen. He said, but what you just did, and he starts to rave about the memory thing. That changed my life because the light bulb went off. And, oh, my God, I didn't think I'd get that kind of reaction. That changed my life. I realized that doing the memory could maybe impress people more than locating their selected card. I don't know.
Right.
But that's the way my mind started. That changed my life.
So then you started working on actually a presentation and a lecture to teach other people about how to do that. Do you have like a couple of memory tips or hints? I mean, I'm sure Johnny Carson and other people over the years have asked you, you know, the same question.
But. Well, you know, I hate to go out of sequence, but you know what just comes to mind? In my first book, How to Develop a Superpower Memory, I teach how to remember the Morse code.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I wasn't interested in Morse code, but somebody said to me, gee, Harry, this is before I wrote the book, boy, if you could teach me how to remember the Morse code,
sure.
Well, I teach it to people in an hour or less, and I'll give you the concept, the way my mind works. First of all, I said, let's make up a word. You know, all memory is based on visualization, you know?
Yep.
Aristotle wrote a book 3,000 years ago, where the first line was, in order to think, we must speculate with images. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do. I speculate with images. Visualization is a very important part of my memory training systems, as is what I call the reminder principle. One thing reminds you of the other. Here's what I made up almost on the spur of the moment. And I'll tell you another addition to that story from years later when I was in the Army. But right now, I'm long before the Army, and this is what I came up with, and I'll give you one example. I say to this man, the first thing you got to do is come up with a vision in your mind that will remind you of a letter of the alphabet, like, what does A sound like? Ape. I can visualize an ape. I don't know if I can visualize the letter A, but I can visualize an ape.
Right.
And what else can ape stand for if not an A?
Mm-hmm.
How about B? Well, how about a B? That comes in sticks. B.
Sure.
How about C? I visualize the ocean, the sea. And so on, okay? Now, all of a sudden, I go over the alphabet with the guy, and he gives me the name we just talked about. Because it's easy. The sound reminds you of this, the reminder principle. A reminds you of ape. Okay. Now, let me make up a code for Dots and Dashes, which is all divorce code is.
Right.
And I never knew it, but I know it's all made up with dots and dashes. Well, let's make the letter R represent a dot. Let's make a T, the letter T, represent a dash, because the T is made up of T dashes. One right side up, one horizontal on top of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. R is dot. T is dash. That's easy to remember. You don't have to be a memory expert for that. But here's a picture for you. This is the only example I'm going to give you. You want to remember that the Morse code symbol for A is dot dash. Mm-hmm. Now, how do I remember that? The original picture I made and the picture I suggested to this guy who asked me this question that started the whole thing, I visualized an ape wringing the neck of a rat. Rat. R-T. Dot dash. It could be nothing else. Huh. That's it. That's the way I taught the, the Morse code. Now I'm going to give you an end to this silly story. Years later, I'm in the army. I had enlisted because I was going to be drafted anyway. So I thought if you had enlisted, it'd be better off. Long story. Anyway, I'm in the army in Camp Blanding, Florida. I'll never forget it because the first thing I saw when we went from New Jersey, Fort Dix, New Jersey, to Camp Blanding, Florida, at 4 in the morning, the train dropped us off there. As we walked in, there was a big poster or picture on the wall, and it showed two MPs dragging Adolf Hitler. They had captured Adolf Hitler, and Adolf Hitler was screaming, "No, no, not Camp Blanding!" So that's where they took us. Anyway, time passes, and I find out that there is a school about 20 miles away from the actual camp that's a six-month course on the Morse code. The first 3 months learning the Morse code, the actual dots and dashes. Mm-hmm. The second 3 months, the actual sending and receiving on the whatever machine, whatever it's called.
Telegraph machine, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So when I find out about this, and they're taking 3 months to teach them the Morse code, and we were losing the war, Scott. Mm-hmm. Really. I mean, this was right after the Bataan Death March in Guadalcanal. You know, I always say if they took me, they were losing the war. We were losing the war. I mean, there's no question about it. Anyway, I want to do a good deed. Sure. So I say to myself, hey, they're taking 3 months to learn the Morse code before they go into the actual sending and receiving. I can teach it to them in 20 minutes if I give them the idea I just told you.
Right.
So I asked my captain, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, he makes an appointment with me for the colonel or general, whoever, who's running the Morse code school. I'm driven there in a Jeep. I get out, I walk in, there's the general writing. He looks up, yes, sir. And he says, what can I do for you? I think I was a private. He says, what can I do for you, private? And I explained, I say to him, I know that you're teaching your students 3 months to learn the Morse code. I could teach it to them. I didn't want to say an hour. That sounded really ridiculous. I said, I could teach it to them in a couple of hours, 2 hours. And you know what happens? How can I forget this? I say, he stands up, he turns red, and he slaps the table, and he says, then what the hell would I do with them for 3 months? And how the hell did he answer that? He scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
I salute. I say, yes, sir, and I left.
He left.
That's it. End of story. So sometimes you can't be a wise guy. You can't show people how great you are, how bright you are. And that was it. That was the end of that story. But I don't know how I got into this, Scott, but you asked me how I could talk about something to actually teach you. Well, I just told whoever's going to listen to this interview how to remember the Morse code.
Yeah, you know, whenever I had learned, it was through the Boy Scouts. And it's like with A, I remember just the shape of the A, the top is a dot, and then you slide along the sign. So it's dot, dot. I'm sorry, dit, dot. So it's a dot and then a dash. And it was like the same thing with SOS, you know, that was, of course, Save Our Ship with the Titanic. When you have the two dots on the end of the S's and then a dot in the middle. So it'll be dot, dot, dot. And then the zero, which would be three long dashes. Right. Yeah, and then the S again, you know, for the dot, dot, dot. Anyhow.
Well, take away. You're using, again, the visualization.
I am visualizing something.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I've written it in just about every one of my books on memory training. I said, even if my systems don't work, they must work. Now, that's a very contradictory statement, but then I will explain it. I would say, even if my systems don't work, they must work. And of course they work beautifully.
Yeah.
But let me explain what I just said. In order to apply my systems, you have to do mainly two or three things that you've never really done before. Like when you meet somebody in a room, I used to watch people at a party or at a meeting talking, and each was looking over the other's left shoulder, you know, to see who was more important. Who is the more important person in this room? Mm-hmm. Little realizing that maybe the person you're talking to right now is the most
important. That's right.
Right. You know, but here's the point. If you try to apply my system, even if they don't work, as I said, although of course they work beautifully, you are forced to do a few things. Let's say you want to remember a person's name. Well, the first thing, you have to hear the name. Most people are not even listening when they hear it. What, in order to apply my, how can you apply it if you don't hear the name? So let's say it's Mr. Bentivania. Oh, so would you say that again? Oh, Mr. Bentivania. In other words, you're paying attention. You have no choice. Mm-hmm. You don't realize it. You don't realize that you're working a little harder than you always have done. That is, you're listening.
Right.
People mostly don't listen. You just listened to the name. The next thing I teach is you have to associate. First, you have to make the name meaningful. How do you make a name like Bentivania meaningful? Well, here again, look what you're doing. You're concentrating on this name like you never concentrated on a name before. What does Bentivania sound like? Well, what I thought, I originally meant a Mr. Bentivania, which is why it just came to mind. I visualized a bent weather vane. Bent vane. That was enough to, and that I could visualize. I could see, you know, any northeast, west, south on it. And I see it being bent. Okay. Again, you have been forced to pay attention, to listen, to think about that name. And the next thing I teach is associate what you just came up with, this example of bent weather vane, to the person's face. And I teach to associate it to an outstanding feature on the person's face. Again, how in the world are you going to know what's an outstanding feature on a person's face? Unless, darn it, you look at that face. Pay attention.
Right.
So I looked at Mr. Bentivania when I first met him. I picked his nose. Let's say he had a big nose. Now, here is the main principle. Tie the two together. That's the key. That's the reminder principle. I want that big nose to remind you of Bentivania, which will remind you of Bentivania. How do you do that? I looked at his face and I didn't see a nose. I saw a big weather vane sticking out there and it's bent. That's it.
Yeah.
Look at what you've just done. Even if my systems don't work, you have listened and you have looked and you have paid attention. All the important things that you rarely do otherwise.
You're exactly right. You know, I've taught a few people about memory as well. And in mine, it's very much along the same line, and that is to focus. I say that whenever that you, when someone gives you their name, first of all, that is the most important thing that they can give you.
Right.
It's more better than money or whatever, because they are born and die with that name. They recall by that name. It's nothing more personal than their name. So recognize that they're giving you a gift. And most people don't. I mean, if you go to a restaurant and the waiter tells you his name, that just kind of goes in one ear and out the other.
Of course.
And we'll get to that in just a minute then also. So then I say, think about it whenever that you are going in for a job interview or you're going to be having a job evaluation and the boss is going to tell you, you know, that you didn't do this good of a job, you know, and you are completely focused in, you know, the hairs in the back of your neck go up because you're going to try to protect yourself. So every word that he says, you're going to try to defend yourself for what you did. So think about how important that is to your life and your career and whatever that they're saying to you. So for at least a few moments, when someone tells you their name, think about, you know, your hair going up in the back of your neck and that being very important. And then finally, as I said, whenever that you go into a restaurant, the best way to try and practice is to say the person's name about three times. So if the person says, my name is Stephen, I'll be your waiter this evening. And so, well, thanks, Stephen. I think I will have some, you know, some sparkling water or whatever. And then, Stephen, what are the specials tonight or whatever? So you just say the name so that way that you remember that, you know.
You
so
lock it in.
Yeah, those are just some things, some tips that I give.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was very young, and I was starting to do these memory demonstrations for the public, I would open by remembering the names of everybody in the audience.
Yeah.
Up to 1,000 people.
I've seen some of that, like on Johnny Carson and other places.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a couple of things about remembering 1,000 people in a moment. But the reason I mention it now is I was very young and I was just starting and I had agents and managers and things like that. And they all said basically the same thing to me. They said, Harry, what you do, remembering everybody's name, that's an 11 o'clock number. That's top of the world. You should close with that. And I said, no. These were supposedly great show business people. They knew that. They were wrong. Because I said, you reminded me by saying how important this is to people. They die with it. They live with it. And that was my thinking. I said, look, I opened by remembering everybody's name. If I'm not going to get them with that, I ain't going to get them. I mean, they love me after that. I remembered their names. For God's sakes, why would I want to leave that to the end? I want them to love me from the beginning. Not only that, when I do the act, which I've done for 100 years, when somebody raises their hand to ask a question, I say, yeah, Mr. Goldberg, what is it? I want to use their names throughout. If I didn't open with that, I couldn't do that. You know, I'd be saving it for the end.
Yeah, similarly, I have that short-term memory. And again, whenever I'm doing strolling and close-up, that whenever I'm leaving the party and I say, you know, thank you, Judy and Jonathan, hey, it was great meeting you. And also, Gladys, I appreciate you helping me with the card trick while ago or whatever. And as I'm leaving, I can see their heads going around. So how does he remember my name?
They're holding a glass.
The first job I ever got out of college was after I had gone in and had spoken. There were three gentlemen there, and I was showing them his portfolio. I was in advertising. And anyhow, as I was leaving, then I thanked each of them by name. And when they called me back in, they said that everyone else had, you know, good credentials and they had a portfolio and all looked really good. But the thing that separated you was that you remembered our names as we left and called us by name. And so that's why we wanted you.
Yeah, that's very important. Now, I told you that I was remembering, it's my ego, I guess, remembering everybody's name in an audience up to 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. But the point here, as I said, you know, you live and learn, obviously. And I was doing a lot of work, very happy, making a lot of money, blah, blah, blah. But when I'm on stage, I have good peripheral vision, or I used to. I also have good peripheral thinking. I can almost read people's minds. And what started to happen, I'm calling off 1,000 people. And by the time, and I'm a fast talker. You know, you hear me. You know I'm a fast talker. And I'm calling off those names like crazy. I would get to the 300th, the 400th, the 500th name. And I start to read the minds of all the people, and they're saying, you know something, we believe you. What else do you do? That, I started to realize, wait a minute, you're remembering 300, 400, 500 names. Don't you think that impressed people enough? Why bore them going on with another 500 people when you can do the next demonstration in your act? That changed the way I worked, and that's what I used to do. If I went into a room, let's say they're having dinner, and most of the things I did as time went by were business groups, and it was a dinner. I was the speaker after dinner, and it's a big room with tables of 10 and 15 people at each table. I started to I wouldn't remember everybody, but I was pretty good at remembering the areas so that when they all stood up, it looked like the entire room.
Right.
But I only did 300, 400 people. And I got the same ovation, I got the same screams and applause as I would if I did 1,000, because I don't want to bore people. You know, that's one of the things that comes to my mind, Scott, as I talk about this. After my first book and after I started to do a lot of appearances, I had more ripoffs. I lost count of the ripoffs I had. I would see people sitting in my audience with a legal pad writing down my words, for God's sakes. They can do the memory stunts I did. I teach it in my books.
Yeah.
That's what started the whole thing. But the point is, they would then get up on stage and do exactly what I did, because what they didn't realize is that I am basically an entertainer. I've written about this so many times. Magic, my first love, and memory. They are my medium of entertainment. I remember saying this so many times. I don't care if you flap your arms, your elbows, and fly around the room. If you're not entertaining, you're going to put your audience to sleep. Yeah. And that's what these people did. They did the stunts. They were able to do the memory stunts, but they weren't entertainers. I am basically an entertainer.
Yeah, that reminds me about Houdini, about how that he was copied so many times, but his name still remains centuries later.
Of course, that's it. And I, over the years, it still happens to this day. And I'm not making appearances anymore, really. I don't want to fly anymore. I had enough with flying. I have flown all over the world. And I've done some appearances. I do magicians here in Massachusetts, but they have to come and pick me up. I could drive in the daytime. I don't want to drive back at night.
Sure.
So, you know, they have to pick me up, et cetera, et cetera. But flying, I don't want to do anymore.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And I always like to close by asking my guests what it is that is their philosophy of life. What is it that you live by? So it's not necessarily a word like, I don't mean abracadabra. I mean, what would be your phrase or something that's important to you when you wake up in the morning?
One of the things that I did, thought about is make other people happy. That was basically what I thought of. That's what made me who I am. I wanted to make other people happy. There comes that entertainment concept again. I made people happy. Yeah.
That sounds great.
So that was kind of the first thing. You know, it started off, I wanted to avoid, I told you this, being punished by my father. Yeah. You know, I once said that, if you still have time, you know, I got to remind you, Scott, somebody once said, it's very hard to start Harry Lorraine, but it's much harder to stop him. So
I recall sitting with you at a lecture at the 4F one time and going until the wee hours of the morning.
Right. That's what I mean. So the reason I mentioned, if I'm talking too much, stop me, okay, Scott. But I don't even know what I was telling you about at the moment. I was on the Johnny Carson. I was on the Tonight Show. And I was telling him that story that I told you about bringing my test from Mrs. Goldfisher for my father to sign. Mm-hmm. And I said my father would punch me about 14 days later, 10 days later. Freddie DeCordova, who was the producer mm-hmm. of The Tonight Show, called me. You got to remember this a long time ago. There was no email. There was regular snail mail. He says to me, Harry, we've gotten 8,000 pieces of mail, or about that many, all negative about you, about something you said. I said, oh, my God, what did I do? He said, you said your father punched you. Mm-hmm. This is a long time ago. I guess you couldn't say that. Because when I told a story after this, I would say my father punished me, and that's okay.
Yes.
But it seemed you couldn't say your father punched you. So I'm trying to tell you, you know, two things happened on the Carson Show like that, where Freddie DeCordova would call me. That was one of them. The other thing is Johnny Carson. Johnny and I became very friendly. He knew my background, blah, blah, blah. So he once says to me, because he thought it would be interesting, on the show, he says, Harry, how does a D's, Dems, and Does kid like you from the Lower East Side with no money, no education, 1 year of high school. Oh, no, he says to me, I'm losing the trend. He opens this remark by saying, Harry, how many degrees do you have? So I start to laugh. I say, Johnny, I have 1 year of high school. He says, that's right. So how does, and now he starts to ask that question, become the memory training specialist in the world. And we go on from there. Freddie DeCordova calls me 10 days later. Oh, Harry, 6,000 pieces of mail, all negative. What the heck did I do? You said you only have 1 year of high school. We have enough trouble keeping our kids in school. We don't want to see an obviously successful guy, because they thought if you're on the Tonight Show, you're successful.
Right.
So we don't want to see an obviously successful person say he has only a year of high school, 1 year of high school. These were all negative. They were not making jokes. They were angry. They were upset. Now, I'm not going to lie, Scott. Let's face it. I don't sound like a PhD. I'm very aware of who I am and what I am. But I'm not going to lie. So now, and it's happened so many times, people will say, oh, Mr. Lorraine, what's your educational background? And I'll say, well, I only have 1 year of high school, but, and I say the but before I take a breath, I say I have only 1 year of high school, but if I had it to do over again, I would certainly get my degree.
Yeah.
Then it's okay. Yeah. So, you know, you got to be careful what you say publicly. Right?
I'm sure that's very true then as well. When you were working there at that club and you were talking about Frank Sinatra, did you ever perform like at Frank Sinatra? Do you have any other stories about him or other celebrities like that? I mean,
Not really. There were so many celebrities that came in. I remember I got friendly with Eddie Fisher. I don't know how many people remember Eddie Fisher now.
Carrie Fisher's singer. Father.
See, in those days, I don't know if they're still doing it. There were big theaters on Broadway, the Paramount, the Lowy's, whatever. And in between the movies, there were live entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, big stars like Eddie Fisher at that time. And it seemed that a lot of these people, these entertainers, when the night was over for them at the movie theater, they would come to Billy Reed's Little Club. It was a very well-known club, to have a drink or a late dinner or whatever. So I met a lot of these people. I remember meeting Richard Widmark, the actor. I don't know how many people remember him now, mm-hmm. but another big star at the time. We became friendly, and they would bring friends and ask me to show them, you know, some tricks. So I would meet a lot of important people there. We got friendly, in a way, only at the club, only with one or two, who I won't mention at the time, that we met outside of the club.
Yeah.
And met, you know, sometimes with me and at my wife, we had just been married, etc. You know, and we went for dinner or something like that.
Right.
In my last book called And Finally! Exclamation point, because it's going to be my last book, in magic, this is for magicians. In the back of the book, 180, 181 page, somebody had asked me to do this, and the heading of the page is Pinpointing an Era. And what I listed, what people had asked me to do, list all the well-known magicians that you knew and were friendly with. I mean, not just met fleetingly. I mean, went to dinner with, were friendly with. They came to your house. I went to their house. All the magicians that you knew, with people like, you know, let's face it, John Scarney, Dave Vernon, Bill Simon, people that I mentioned before. So there's a big paragraph, that much, with I don't know how many names. And the second part is non-magicians who you were friendly with, like Frank Sinatra, you know, Dick Cavett, although Dick is interested in magic also. Yeah. But people like that, Alan and Arlene Alda, who are very close friends of mine, Mel Brooks, and Bradford, names like that. And again, God knows how many names. And I called it Pinpointing an Era. These are the people that I was friendly with, both in magic and outside of magic in my younger years.
Can I ask you a question along that line then? I recall again when you were at the 4F convention, and I believe you might have been the guest of honor that year, and Frank Garcia was there, and I knew that seems like when you were in the room, he wasn't, and vice versa. It seems like you were just kind of apart.
We were not friendly toward the end of his life, no.
Okay.
We were friendly, when we were young, well, we were still in short pants, you know.
Yeah.
We were friendly, but then he started to do things that did not strengthen that friendship at all. He started to steal stuff.
I remember
teaching him a thing. I have in one of my books, an impromptu linking card trick, where one card was torn and made into two frames, and they linked magically. He asked me to teach it to him one time. He was going out on he was going to do lectures around in America, and he asked me to teach him that trick, and I did. It ends up, I heard people telling me he was teaching it at his lectures, like as if it was his own trick. And then I had a good friend in Rome, in Italy, by the name of Tony Binarelli.
I know Tony.
I remember. Yeah.
He does mentalism and great card work.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he helped me when I was doing television in Italy. He was driving me around, you know, helping me out, etc. He and his wife. Mm-hmm. So he was a good friend.
Yeah.
But he also published a magazine. At one time, he sent me a copy of his magazine in Italian. And there's a picture of the Lincoln cards. And it's Frank Sinatra's. It says
Frank Sinatra. Frank Garcia.
Frank Garcia's trick. Well, that's what started the I told Tony this. Tony said, gee, Harry, I didn't know. And on a future magazine, he said, my mistake, that's Harry Lorraine's, you know, blah, blah, blah. But that started the non-friendship between me and Frank, which
and
was
Frank
a
never,
shame.
Frank didn't come back and apologize or start giving
no,
you credit?
Frank was the kind of guy, David Roth told me this, you know, David Roth, the coin.
Very good
guy.
Friend. Yep, good guy.
Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. David Roth, what Frank did, took what a David Roth trick that had to do with a, I don't know, a pad with a hole in it like a sewer and a coin disappeared. I don't remember the trick, but it was David's. Anyway, Frank started to show
it. It was the portable hole, I think.
Ah, there you go. Yep. Okay. Frank started to do it as if it was his. Now, why am I telling you this? Because David told me this. David faced Frank and he said, Frank, you've taken my trick and calling it yours. And Frank said, so?
Wow, just like that. Wow.
Just like that. That's who we were dealing with.
Okay.
So, no, we never got together again. But I got to tell you, and I got some very good remarks about this, and I didn't do it for that reason. Frank Garcia died. Mm-hmm. And in the issue of Apocalypse that came, that I was able to write after his death, the last thing I wrote with a black margin because of death and also to call attention to it, I told the story that this person and I did not, we were friends when we were children and growing up, but toward the end we stopped speaking to each other. We were not friends, blah, blah, blah. I said how we would spend time together. And toward the end I said, the person I'm talking about is Frank Garcia, mm-hmm. who passed away recently, and the magic lights in the world will never be as bright.
Hmm.
So I wasn't going to say bad things about him when he died.
Of course.
And I said that I felt that the magic lights of the world would never be as bright without Frank Garcia.
Sure. So
and I meant it.
A little bit dimmer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they would be a bit dimmer, right?
Boy,
that's what I said. Yeah.
Like recently, we've just lost Norm Nielsen, you know, and of course, Johnny Thompson last year, you know. Just
What's his name, Daryl?
And Daryl, yes.
Daryl mm-hmm. Martinez, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He killed himself.
Hung himself at Magic Castle. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I never found out why. He was, you know, I knew him fleetingly, not very well. He's not on that list I told you about.
Yeah.
People I was that friendly with. But we met once or twice and blah, blah, blah. Did anyone ever know why he did this?
I don't think that has been made publicly clear.
No.
No. You know, another one over in England who was young and died was Anthony Owen. Yeah. He was one who'd worked with Darren Brown and others, and I had him on the podcast some time ago then as well. But, I think our lights are dimmer whenever that we lose some of these titans like that. So, which is why that I want you to keep in good health. I want you to live another 93 years.
Please, I don't want to. It's funny, you mentioned Darren Brown. I don't know if you ever saw it. You know, it was
I saw him in New York. I came out to see him there at the Court Theater. Uh-huh.
Right. No, I didn't see him. But, you know, 4 years ago, a birthday party was thrown for me in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And there were Paul Gordon flew in from London for just that day. He flew back the same night or next morning. Oh, there were hundreds of people there, big names in magic, but a lot of them that couldn't make it, and Darren Brown was one of them, mm-hmm. did a video. for me, like David Copperfield and Derren Brown and Penn and Teller, all big names. And Derren Brown was one of them. So it just reminded me. It seems he learned a lot, he said, from my books and et cetera. You know, well, so that was very nice.
You have been influential for more than one generation of magicians, certainly over the years with your writings, your teachings. Your influence has just gone far and wide. So I thank you on behalf of our community. Thank you very much.
I'll give you one. David Copperfield made a video. He couldn't make it. And I'll give you this ending, and if you want to end it there, you can, if you want to, Scott. When I was Lieutenant had asked me to write Tar Bell number 7, and he said he advertised to magicians that if you have a trick that you think would fit in Tar Bell, Harry Lorraine is writing it. He's usually here every Saturday, but he's in town. If you want to come up and show him that trick, blah, blah, blah. Okay? So one Saturday, this young, good-looking boy by the name of David Kutkin comes over to me, and he said, "Oh, Mr. Lorraine," he introduces himself, "can I show you a trick for Tar Bell?" I'd say, "Sure." And he does a trick, if I remember correctly, with a fountain pen or something. And I said, "Well, it's a nice trick. Let me think about it, you know, and I'll see if I want to use it." And he says, "Mr. Lorraine, if you put that trick in Apocalypse, and if I ever make it, I will give you 10% of my earnings for the rest of my life."
So that's why you're doing so well.
That became David Copperfield. Now, the reason I mention it is that my birthday, 4 years ago, my 90th birthday, there's David Copperfield. Now, there were 40 people on that video wishing me, you know, happy birthday. Okay, here's David Copperfield talking about me and how we met and blah, blah, blah. And at the very end, he says very quietly, "Oh, and Harry, that 10% check is in the mail."
In the mail. Great story.
Right.
Thank you, Harry, very much for your time. I appreciate it. I know the listeners do as well. It's great spending time with you there. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Harry Lorraine. This is Scotty out. Wow. What can I say? Wow. That was fantastic. Pretty epic. Something that you might want to download from your favorite place, wherever you download your podcast, and keep it. This is one you may want to go back and listen to from time to time. A legendary magician. It's great to spend some time with him. And Harry, thank you so much for your time and your dedication to the art of magic and for all of your contributions over the years. We all cannot thank you enough. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thanks for being a guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. And again, I thank each of you listeners for coming back. And if you would like to know who's going to be coming up next week, we've got another person who is very interesting and has a great background and someone who is well known in the magic community then as well. And I know that you will enjoy this. We're going in a completely different direction from what we did this week. And if you are a subscriber to the weekly pod letter, then you know who that person is going to be. If you don't, then go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you can subscribe to the pod letter and, of course, become a friend of the Magic Word, where you can donate with a one-time pledge or an ongoing monthly pledge through patreon.com. So again, thank you very much, and until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to just make people happy. This is Scotty out.